Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I'd like to subscribe to this podcast. Derek McElhinney, Eric Prahl, Meg Middleton, and Franklin A. Brown Jr. Go to peterbcollins.com and get all the details and your subscriptions. Appreciate it. Two great journalists on today's podcast. In the second portion, Jason Leopold returns from truthout.org. His FOIA requests have produced some very interesting documents from the Department of Homeland Security related to their monitoring of Occupy Wall Street and the Occupy movements around the country. That's coming up a little bit later. Joining me now is Charles Glass. He has a powerful article in the April issue of Harper's Magazine called The Warrior Class, A Golden Age for the Freelance Soldier. Charlie Glass has been a journalist for many years, reporting from the Middle East and elsewhere. And he joins us today from the south of France, where he is the winter caretaker of the Maison Rouge. Charlie, how are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Thanks for joining us. And tell me a little bit about, let's focus first on Tim Spicer. It's the focal point of your article. He's a retired British military man who rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel. And he started a company called Aegis, which has become one of the leading military contractors, mercenary providers. And you traveled to Afghanistan to see the action on the ground there. Tell us a little bit about Tim Spicer and how he got involved in the hired soldier business.
Tim Spicer was originally a colonel in the British Army. I first came across him in Bosnia back in 92, 93 when he was there with Michael Rose. And he was more or less a spokesman. He was in the Scots Guard. He's more or less a spokesman. So he got to know quite a few of the journalists there at the time. He could see then that his career wasn't really going anywhere. The British Army was scaling down. It was very unlikely he was going to make general. So he went off to become a banker and didn't really like that very much. And he was attracted into the old-style mercenary business. He worked with a company called Sandline, named for the land and the line in the sand that George Bush drew in Kuwait. And they did mercenary contracting of the old type in Africa. So an African dictator would commission mercenaries to come in and get rid of their opponents, or the opponents would pay the mercenaries to get rid of the government. It was a very popular thing in the 60s and 70s. People like Major Bob Denau of France and Mad Mike Hoare of South Africa made a lot of money doing that kind of operation. Tim did an operation for Sandline in Sierra Leone where they tried to put back the elected government, which had been deposed by rebels, put back the elected government and started again. In fact, they succeeded, but the British Foreign Office tried to shut them down and say that they had done this illegally because there was an arms embargo on Sierra Leone at the time, but it all came out later that, in fact, the Foreign Office had given complete approval to Spicer, had more or less bankrolled Spicer's operation, and Spicer was exonerated. But he had to move on because Sandline was slightly tainted. He had a similar bad experience in Papua New Guinea, again with old-style mercenary operations, working for a government, trying to get rid of rebels, being involved with opening up a mine, and so forth. Again, it didn't work out very well, and there was a lot of bad publicity surrounding it. And then he was sort of on the outs. He wasn't really going anywhere. And he started a little company called Aegis Defense Systems, which started doing contracting for merchant marine security. Because, as you know, piracy has been on the up for the last 15 years, right, particularly around the Horn of Africa and the Malacca Straits. And he was advising companies on how best to protect their ships against pirates. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of money in that, in mercenary terms. But then came really the gold mine, not just for Tim Spicer, but for Blackwater and all the other defense contractors, or the private security contractors, when Bush and Cheney and Bremer in Iraq were giving out millions of dollars for private protection of the armed forces and private protection of contractors. Mm-hmm. Spicer came to Iraq after the invasion, managed to get a contract to coordinate the operations of all of the other contractors who were there working for the Department of Defense and the State Department, who were doing stupid things like shooting at one another, making so much trouble in Fallujah that some of them were lynched, getting a very bad reputation for the industry and for the U.S. and Iraq by their reckless behavior. And he came in with a contract which was, as I recall, it was something like $264 million from the U.S. government to coordinate these operations and try and control them so that they didn't run wild the way they did before. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, it was successful. But he went from a company that was making less than $1 million a year to one that was, after a few years, had over $1 billion in U.S. government contracts. So yeah, the real turning point for those companies was the Iraq invasion. And then, of course, the contractors making so much money in Iraq got into Afghanistan as well, and they're still operating in Afghanistan, although President Hamid Karzai wants to get rid of them.
Right, and actually a deadline has come and gone. We'll address that in a few minutes. Before we go in depth here on the feeding frenzy at the Pentagon in Iraq and Afghanistan, you referred to Spicer's operations in Papua New Guinea and elsewhere as old mercenary. What is the distinction in your mind about the way it used to work and the way it works now? And to what extent were, say, in Papua New Guinea, Sandline's operations a proxy for the British government? Because you do say that the High Commissioner had generally approved these operations and actually helped to bail out Spicer when he got himself in two different pickles.
Well, yes, in the Cold War, the Western governments would often use mercenaries like Bob Dinar. The French used Bob Dinar to conquer a whole country. Bob Dinar, a white mercenary, ran the Comor Islands for 10 years with French approval. The Mad Mike Hoare used to run around taking over parts of Africa for the South African, the apartheid regime in South Africa. Tim Spicer, with Sandline, was operating. He would go in as an armed adventurer, soldier of fortune, with other armed men, do the operations, take the money or be paid the money, and leave. And this would allow the governments, the British, the French, the United States, the governments deniability, so that they could say if something went wrong, it was nothing to do with them. It wasn't like sending their own army in. Well, that's all gone away now in the post-Cold War world and in the war on terror. The governments are now contracting them to do military services that the military is not going to do for itself. For example, protecting its bases. Now, it would sound very odd to any taxpayer who is paying U.S. income tax to an army, an air force, a navy, and a marine corps to protect him and his family, to find out that, in fact, he's also paying someone else to protect that marine corps and that air force. So the bases are no longer protected by the soldiers themselves. They're protected by armed mercenaries, privately paid armed contractors. It just is the U.S. quartermaster corps of the army no longer feeds the army. That's done by Halliburton at vast cost. Mm-hmm. Now, similarly, the very protection of the forces themselves, and it's called force protection, is done privately. And it's been an absolute windfall for people like Eric Prince and others who have made hundreds of millions of dollars in this way, providing services that the U.S. armed forces used to provide for themselves.
And some of these companies really sprung up kind of like, like sprouts in a warehouse, just as soon as the money became available. And, you know, most people had never heard of Dyncorp, of Triple Canopy, Titan, Khaki, Custer Battles. Jeremy Scahill of The Nation magazine, who really has been a dogged beat reporter on the mercenary issues since, really, we invaded Iraq. But you offer some very interesting dimensions, and I want to point out what I consider to be a critical bit of information in one of your footnotes, Charlie, and that is about L. Paul Bremer. I used to call him Boots Bremer because when he was running the occupation in Iraq, he'd show up in a suit and tie and always had combat boots on. And you point out his connection to Kissinger Associates. And most people have no idea where Paul Bremer came from. He was shipped in after the first, it was a retired general.
Jay Garner.
Say his name again?
General Jay Garner.
Yeah, Jay Garner.
In a few weeks.
Yeah,
he was a career military man, and probably too honest for them.
Yeah, they cashiered him faster than Who Shot Bob. And here comes Paul Bremer. And, what you know, he debathified the government, which everyone now recognizes as a... And he was handing out all kinds of contracts, and he also took care of the contractors by giving them immunity in the series of orders that he issued as he was leaving Iraq.
That's right. So they could not be prosecuted for killing Iraqis. That's true.
Mm-hmm. So I just think that's an important detail that many people...
It's important
people...
because, remember, in the United States Armed Forces, there is a military justice system, and if a soldier gets out of line, he will be court-martialed. Whereas under Bremer's program in Iraq, if a private contractor got out of line and killed some people, he couldn't be touched.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did Tim Spicer and Aegis end up with a contract where they were essentially the control tower for the military contractors? Because it was pretty wild and woolly. There was little coordination,
well,
right?
Iraq with no contracts, and he was looking around at various things, including protecting oil installations and so forth. And he wasn't an old military man. He could see that what was going on wasn't working. And it was his suggestion, initially, that someone had to coordinate this. And if the U.S. Armed Forces were not going to coordinate them, because they didn't want to, the U.S. Armed Forces didn't want to go near these people, by the way. So they... He suggested it to the Department of Defense, and the Department of Defense then invited people to bid for it. And since he knew what he was bidding for, since it was his idea in the first place, he got the contract.
Mm-hmm. And isn't that kind of odd? Or
if you come in with the lowest bid and the most presentable bid, then it's not odd at all. I mean, look, I mean, when you're going against Blackwater, which nobody wanted to touch by that stage, because they were the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the biggest as well. So to be, but hardly anyone else had any credibility. Whereas he hadn't been in Iraq, he hadn't blotted his copybook. He was highly regarded in the British military, and they spoke up for him. And there were British military officers in the CPA who spoke up for him and spoke up for him with the Department of Defense. And I expect between the bid that he made and their recommendation that he was given it. But because these things aren't done publicly, we'll never know.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's fast forward to the present, because in Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai has repeatedly tried to get the mercenaries, the paid military contractors, out of his country, and most recently set a deadline for last week, March 20th. Have they all left, Charlie?
None have left. In the first instance, and now it's going to be pushed back again because the Afghan private protection force, public protection force, which they're setting up to replace the private contractors, isn't ready yet. I mean, coincidentally, it's being trained by American private contracting companies, so they're probably not in any hurry to get them up and running. The other problem is that many of the big companies in Afghanistan and some of the NGOs in Afghanistan don't trust an Afghan protection force to look after them. And one of the reasons is that sometimes Afghans see those companies and those NGOs as part of an occupation force. So it can be a bit risky for these operations that are trying to work in Afghanistan to rely on an all Afghan force to look after them.
Mm-hmm. There's also a political risk to Karzai being seen as protected by a cadre of non-Afghans. Doesn't that make him, at least in the perception of many Afghans, linked to the occupiers.
Well, when Karzai first appeared in Kabul with armed guards from a private company, American company, with their sunglasses and their automatic weapons and their bulletproof vests and so forth, he was perceived immediately as a stooge of the Americans, protected by the Americans, just as the way old rulers like Shah Shuja Durrani in their history were protected by the British or later by the Russians and were seen simply as a stooge. He eventually got rid of his Americans. Political relations disaster for him. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, he was put in power by the Americans. He's treading a very fine line between trying to please his American benefactors and yet somehow retain a degree of credibility with the Afghan public. But I think his credibility with the Afghan public is so low anyway, it wouldn't make much difference.
Now, Charlie, you traveled to Afghanistan and you met Tim Spicer there. Could you describe for our listeners the gauntlet that you ran of various uniformed or other guards, all working for different and reporting to different authorities?
Are you talking about the American Embassy?
Yes,
Well, yes, it's interesting. The American Embassy is still protected by Armor Corps, which has lost the contract. Tim Spicer has got the contract, but he hasn't taken over yet. There's going to be a transition process. But to get into the American Embassy, which is a huge compound in the center of Kabul, which looks like, it doesn't look like anything in Kabul itself, you have to walk from the main square in the center of Afghanistan through a series of roadblocks. You have to walk, but you can't drive it. You know, a series of roadblocks, checkpoints by Gurkhas, by Afghan police, by Armor Corps, and then finally by a U.S. Marine. It takes a good half an hour just to get in.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel safe in there?
You would if you didn't know that it had been attacked for 20 hours last September from a rooftop not far away, when the guards in the embassy, including the State Department's own security staff and the Marines, had a firefight with these Afghan insurgents who attacked the embassy from a high point overlooking it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not terribly secure, but the diplomats there now feel they're secure again and cleared.
But it is a bit of a bubble, isn't it, that kind of puts them out of touch with the reality of the scene on the ground there?
It's a completely separate. It's like the Green Zone in Baghdad. It's a completely separate city. There's 16,000 diplomats and other ancillary personnel working there who live, eat, and work on site, and they very rarely come into any contact with the Afghans.
Mm-hmm. And so, Charlie, as we see this playing out, many Americans, anybody who pays attention, are rightfully skeptical of the idea that the Afghans are ready to take over the overall security of the country. It's widely reported that Karzai has some control over Kabul and very little control over the rest of his sprawling nation. This, insight into the military contractors just as a baseline, are the Afghans ready to take over even the security of dignitaries in Kabul, in the bubble?
They don't, because visiting dignitaries will be protected by foreign private security companies, and that's allowed. Also, even under Karzai's Decree 62, even when it comes into force, if it ever comes into force, excludes diplomatic protection under the Vienna Conventions. It excludes various military contracts, protecting of DOD sites, and it will also transform some of the private security companies into something called risk management companies, and risk management will be allowed to continue as well. When you talk about Karzai not controlling Kabul, Karzai can't even enforce building codes in Kabul. Forget about security for a moment. There's a program going on in Kabul. People building, first of all, stealing land, and there's nothing that can be done if you're a private citizen having your land stolen by some warlord. Stealing land, building high buildings on it with no code, no inspection, nothing. And Kabul sits on a fault line. It's had terrible earthquakes in the past, and Karzai has been unable even to enforce building codes and property rights codes in Kabul, let alone provide security.
Now, Charlie, that kind of conflicts with the idea that we're given in the mainstream media in this country, which is that what we consider to be massive corruption, Karzai considers to be patronage. And typically, patronage systems do work, at least for the people who are in the club. And you know, I got my education about that from the Daily Machine in Chicago. Does the system work for insiders at all, or is it just a total total waste?
Well, the insiders are the people who steal land in Kabul from private citizens, warlords of the Northern Alliance, the Karzai family. They're all doing very well out of it. I mean, there's been a huge banking scandal with the Bank of Afghanistan where billions of dollars disappeared, and no one has been able to account for it, where it went, and nothing's being done about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a few honest, decent Afghan politicians and civil servants who would like to do things about it, but they are absolutely powerless. And they're stuck between a corrupt machine, not unlike the Daily Machine, but obviously much more violent.
Yeah.
A corrupt machine on one side and then fear of the Taliban on the other side. It is an untenable position for them.
And, Charlie, I realize that you traveled there before the recent shooting spree that is alleged to have been conducted by Sergeant Robert Bales. And this is produced on the heels of the Quran burning and the video of the soldiers pissing on dead Afghans. Just a real setback for the American occupation. What is your sense of just how tenable it remains? Will the U.S. Agree to Karzai's demand, essentially to hold our forces on base, to turn over the prison at Parwan to the Afghans, and essentially for the U.S. to dial back its role in the occupation?
The thing is, the U.S. either going to occupy it and run it, or it isn't. I doubt that in the long run it's going to want to commit the forces necessary to have the kind of occupation that they had in South Vietnam, for example, and which also was not successful. Ultimately, the U.S. is going to have to leave. It's a question of whether it leaves now, having killed as many American and soldiers and Afghan civilians as it has, or leaves in several years, killing far more on both sides.
Mm-hmm. And, Charlie, when you talked to people during your visit there, were they aware of the negative night raids and the kind of arbitrary entry into private homes and the intrusion into the women and children, which is a real cultural issue? Do the Americans really seem to understand that we're not winning hearts and minds, and if anything, we are preserving connections to the opposition, which is broadly called the Taliban?
Well, everyone is aware that the Afghans do not like being bombed. Everyone is aware that they don't like the drone attacks, which kill people indiscriminately. Everyone is aware that the Afghans do not like their houses invaded at night or in the day, and that they don't like having their families killed. The American diplomats are aware of this. American soldiers are aware of this. But they're running a war, and they don't see any other way of doing it. That's how they did it in Vietnam. That's how they've done it in other places. They're going to go on doing it in Afghanistan as long as they're there. If they stop doing it, what is their role there? What are they doing at all?
Mm-hmm. Is there a mission? Do the people on the ground have a sense of what they're really supposed to be doing?
The mission changes. As you know, after the Twin Towers and the Pentagon were hit in 2001, the mission was to find al-Qaeda and eliminate it in Afghanistan. Well, Osama bin Laden is dead. Basically, al-Qaeda is in Afghanistan is finished. It's moved to Pakistan. And so, in a sense, the objective has been achieved. Then the objective became to stabilize Afghanistan, i.e., the same thing the Soviets tried when they invaded Afghanistan, to put in a government friendly to its interests, which will somehow be swallowed by the people. But the people of Afghanistan have never, whether it was the British, the Soviets, or the Americans, a government, and I doubt that that's going to change.
Mm-hmm. And, Charlie, recently when Leon Panetta was flying to a NATO meeting in Brussels, he told American reporters that he thinks we can move up the exit, and it was a very fuzzy commitment on his part. He didn't commit to a specific date, but was trying to move it up a year in people's minds. He referred only to combat troops, and recently in testimony before Congress, we've heard military brass pushing back, saying that we can't continue with less than 60,000-70,000 troops there through 2013. So the signals are very mixed, and I regarded Panetta's comments as a very clever trap that Mitt Romney immediately stepped into, where it posed the Obama administration as the side that from Afghanistan, and then Romney immediately said, oh, no, we can't do that, and John McCain is there pushing on the same track. So what do you see as the reality of when American forces actually might leave Afghanistan in significant numbers?
Well, I don't know. Those are decisions made in Washington. I can say that it would make sense to leave immediately. It would have made sense to leave several years ago. But what they decide in Washington, I can't say, because, I'm not in Washington, and two, I don't believe anything they say anyway.
Well put, Charlie. Well, listen, thank you for joining us today, and I want to recommend your article. If it were up on the Harper's Magazine website, I would link to it so people could get it, but they're going to have to pick up the magazine. It's the April 2012 edition, and the story is titled The Warrior Class. We've been talking with Charles Glass. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Peter. Thank you very much.
How's that Freedom of Information Act thing working out for you, huh? Jason Leopold returns to our program today, the intrepid investigative reporter.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend. Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within. Smiling faces.
When we last left Jason Leopold, he had informed us about the Freedom of Information Act and ways that the government fails to live up to its obligations under that law. He told us about the internal blackballing process at the Justice Department. And last week, as we mentioned in our daily news and commentary podcast, he and his news organization, truthout.org, released the first round of articles based on the release of documents from the Department of Homeland Security in response to FOIA requests filed by Mr. Leopold here, asking for information about surveillance and other police activities related to the Occupy movement. Jason Leopold, always good to talk to you.
Hey, Peter, great to be back with you.
So you've been really busy lately.
Very busy.
And
very
how
busy, and it just seems like time's going by very quickly as I'm working on these.
And how many more FOIA requests have you filed since I last spoke to you?
It's funny. I actually just filed one yesterday. You know, as I indicated during one of our previous conversations, FOIA can be very addicting. And for me, having that addictive personality, that's exactly what it is. I probably filed about a half dozen, maybe 10, since we last spoke. In fact, I filed a new one yesterday, Sunday, in which I'm basically seeking, and it's related to this, any sort of conversations or memos or photos or transcripts, all records, basically, between Department of Homeland Security's Intelligence and Analysis Division and NYPD, because, as you know, that's where many of the or most of the violent outbreaks with regard to the Occupy movement are taking place.
Wait a minute, Oakland wants.
Yeah, I know. Oakland is obviously, yes. It's clearly, I don't think anyone should, I don't know. If they want to have monopoly on, being the most violent in terms of police action, okay. But
well, and there is no benefit to competing police organizations trying to hit the bottom.
Right.
And in this country, there have been problems with the New York Police Department. Ask Abner Diallo. That's just one example. And the Oakland Police Department has been under federal court supervision now for 5 or 6 years, coming out of what was called the Riders scandal.
Right.
And under that, Oakland was required to develop new crowd control policies, and explicitly they have used tear gas and other mechanisms that are a clear violation of the federal court order.
Right.
And so which police department is more out of control? Well, that's a prize I never want to award. But your point is correct that New York is the center of the Occupy Wall Street movement, and that the police overreaction with the wild pepper spray use back last September is really what propelled it onto the front pages. And I often deplore that it is some sort of violence, whether it's by the cops or by protesters, that's what it takes to get covered. But that's one of the kind of obscene realities in American media today.
Right, exactly, yeah. So, you know, it's important to at least try to get that information. And so, yeah, I filed a new FOIA request yesterday for that. Just to give you a little bit more insight, I filed a FOIA request with NSA based on the groundbreaking article in Wired by James Bamford, a massive facility that's being built in Utah.
In Bluffton or Bluffville, that's called.
So I don't expect anything from the National Security Agency, but with regard to that, but I did file it. And just on one more note, with the National Security Agency, they recently responded to a FOIA request. I was always hoping I'd get one of these. They issued a GLOMAR response to one request that I filed. That's kind of rare. You don't normally. Those don't go out often. GLOMAR responses, in which
is that G L O M A R, like the GLOMAR Explorer?
That's what it's based on.
Really?
And it basically states that you know what it means is that the government agency cannot confirm or deny the existence of any records because the mere confirmation or denial itself is a secret.
Yeah. Well, just one more before we move on. Sibel Edmonds and I interviewed James Bamford recently following his Wired article, and that is Boring Frogs post, I think, later this week, and then we'll have it here at peterbcollins.com shortly after. And Bamford also appeared on the PBS NewsHour, where he was able to challenge some of the spin of a guy named Leiter, Michael Leiter, who was there speaking for the government.
Yeah, that's it's unbelievable what's happening. And then, you know, these new guidelines that were issued last week, which basically by the Obama administration, which basically states that the government can now keep the data of U.S. citizens for 5 years, and that it needs to actually look through the data of people who, you know, may not even be terrorists. Or suspected terrorists in order to, I guess, try to find if there's a threat out there someplace.
And this new policy established under Obama provides a holding period that is 10 times longer than the one that was established by Michael Mukasey, the third Bush Attorney General, as he issued a series of you'd call them executive orders, but he's not. He doesn't rank high enough for that. But arbitrary orders that were not codified by Congress in any way, and he established these new practices as a baseline after Obama was elected, based on the fear that Obama was going to dismantle Dick Cheney's state police apparatus.
Yeah, I wonder if they're having dinner at this point. You know, Obama and that crowd. I mean, it basically, in my opinion, what it is that what this administration has done is you know, put in place total information awareness, which John Poindexter had proposed during the Bush years. And if you recall the reaction then, it was completely set aside, or so we're told, and that's essentially what they're doing right now. And the fact that it's happening under this president, again, I just feel the need to continue to emphasize that, is so disappointing, so troubling, so it's just unbelievable when you look back on, you know, where we were prior to just, you know, during the campaign before Obama was elected, and the attitude by members of Congress toward these civil liberties violations and what needs to be upheld and where we are currently and where those very same people, and I'm speaking specifically about Democrats. I mean, the Republicans, not to get too, you know, too deep into this, but the Republicans never made a secret of where they stood.
Right.
We knew where they stood. The difference here is that we were told that this was a different stance that they had, and in the 3 years, it's no surprise that people have become so disillusioned, not just with politics, but they've become disillusioned with, you know, a particular party, the Democrats, who have, basically gone back on everything they once stood for, specifically with regard to, you know, these terrorism policies.
Well, and the anti-Occupy legislation that was passed that
right.
allows them to arbitrarily set up charge crimes with the potential of a felony conviction for either entering or remaining one of these arbitrarily designated restricted areas.
Right.
I mean, when you put that together with Holder's rationale about due process not really required to kill an American citizen like
right.
Anwar al-Awlaki, the detention bill that allows an American citizen accused of terrorism to be held indefinitely.
Right.
And you know, I'm saying this in a narrow sense that the holding period for this information that is not related to a criminal investigation. Let's
right.
be very clear about that.
Right.
This is not based on probable cause.
No,
this is
not
based
at all.
On we've got this information and we're going to keep it for 5 years
right.
and we're going to run it through those big computers in Utah that can decrypt anything. And hey, we might come up with a match to detain you later on.
Right.
And you know, to see Democrats not only silent, but at least in terms of the legislation, voting
right.
for a lot of this crap, it shows that we've got a real problem in trying
right.
to restore constitutional rule in this country.
Yeah, we have such a long way to go, Peter. I mean, it's first of all, you know, I don't see any, don't think that anything's going to be dismantled, repealed, rolled back, at all. You know, that's sort of a scary thought. It is, you know, whether people want to call it the new normal, police state, it is what will remain in place for sure.
And we can't rely on the courts to provide a
Absolutely
check or
not.
A balance, and the oversight of Congress lapsed a long time ago.
Right.
So, Jason, related to the documents you received from the Department of Homeland Security, if you could, give us a quick sketch of the timeline
sure.
of when you first filed a FOIA request and what kind of a dance you got before you finally got the documents in mid-March.
Yes, I was the first to file a FOIA request with Department of Homeland Security for these documents, as well as with FBI, and I did that on October 31st. So I filed a FOIA request. I sought all records, basically, that the agency had on Occupy Wall Street. And, you know, I was very specific. I asked for emails, memos, transcripts, audio, video, photographs, et cetera. And I also, you know, asked for it to be expedited. So, you know, because this was ongoing, because there was, you know, suspicion that DHS was involved in some way, I asked them to expedite it. They agreed to do that. They, you know, because it was, they asked me to narrow it to senior officials, as opposed to the you know, the FOIA offices around the country, the sort of field offices. And I agreed to do that because I can, you know, always file a you know, a separate FOIA request, which I've done for the field offices. And I have to say, Peter, I was actually pleasantly surprised by my dealings with DHS, because they you know, they not only granted me expedited processing, but through, you know, at least with regard to the FOIA process itself, they're a very easy agency to work with in order to, you know, obtain these records. So, you know, I asked them for an estimated date of completion. They provided me with that. some time back. They, you know, they said it was March 15th at first. They contacted me to let me know it was changing. So in terms of dealing with, you know, various government agencies with regard to FOIA, they have actually been, you know, one of the best. So,
and there was no blackball attempt?
As far, you know what, it's funny. I have no idea, but I will tell you that I have since filed a, you know, a FOIA for the processing note. So to really understand, as I, you know, as we discussed previously,
mm-hmm.
you know, what went on behind the scenes during the processing of this FOIA request. I think that, you know, will hopefully give me some insight, will give other people some insight as well. And so they, you know, they released about 400 pages of documents, and this covers a time frame beginning early September, around, you know, about right around the week or, you know, that protest on September 17th
mm-hmm.
In New York. And it goes to about November or December. So this is only, however, the first batch of documents. There are actually more documents that will be released in the weeks ahead.
Okay.
And I'm expecting in sometime in mid-April another batch of documents. And they said that they're releasing it on a rolling basis. And that's actually something I appreciate, is that they're releasing it on a rolling basis instead of just waiting, which they can do. And I think in terms of trying to just to avoid litigation, that as soon as they get it cleared, as soon as it's processed and cleared for release, you know, after a disclosure analyst goes through it, they're releasing it. They'll continue to roll it out. I mean, during my one of my last conversations with a FOIA analyst, they said the next batch of documents will be operational records, perhaps. They even have documents from the Coast Guard, from TSA, which I have no idea what actually any involvement was with TSA and Occupy. So it will be, you know, it will be very interesting. And I think that these documents that were released really provide some, you know, some deep insight into the agency's interest in Occupy Wall Street. It, to me, certainly proves that there was some monitoring going on at the very early stage, you know, pretty much at the inception, that there was also concerns about civil liberties violations based on the fact that there was, you know, monitoring taking place or, you know, what appeared to be monitoring that perhaps rose to the level of unconstitutional surveillance of First Amendment protection that,
mm-hmm.
you know, that people have. So it's very, very interesting, you know, to see, first of all, that there were those concerns. But I do want to make a point that even though that was raised, there were many people who were already aware within DHS that what they were saying, what they were disseminating, any sort of reports that went back and forth, that they were aware and notified that, obviously, at least according to the documents, that FOIA requests have been filed. Because on two documents I saw on there, it says this document or these records have been are now the subject of a FOIA request.
Well, and Jason, first of all, I found it remarkable in the excerpts that I've read at truthout.org that there was a fair amount of back and forth discussion about respect for the First Amendment. Now, it doesn't address the motive for that respect, and I want to get into that next. But I appreciate that people who are in this department that many of us distrust, that has been created to, it's a huge creation of the small government administration of Bush and Cheney.
Right.
And it's a sprawling organization that includes the Immigration Service, and we don't know what level of coordination it provides for local police agencies. That's another thing I want to touch on.
Right.
But I do appreciate that there was this discussion. Now let's speculate as to motive. Are these people who are saying we got to be careful because this could intrude on First Amendment rights, are they doing that because they're afraid of being caught or because they actually care about my Bill of Rights?
Well, I think that they do, at least in my opinion. Now, look, I don't know if, you know, if there was a motive or what they were thinking at the time. Perhaps, look, you know, this is eventually going to become public. In a way, it sort of reminds me of some of those early intelligence community statements in which, you know, they were involved with the detainees, and they said, oh, you know, one day we're going to end up before Congress, you know, testifying about this for war crimes or what have you. So, you know, I don't know if they felt that, look, you know, this is eventually going to become public, so we need to pay attention. But I think I'm based on what I read. I think that there were clearly some who, you know, felt that, look, you know, this is our job is to to not surveil, you know, protest movements because that's you know, that's protected and it's unconstitutional and it does violate civil liberty. You know, it actually for them to and I do think it's insightful and important because it at least shows that, you know, you don't have you know, that there are people that speak up. Look, you know, we have both spoken to many whistleblowers over the years, and these are whistleblowers who worked, you know, in the government, who saw this type of activity taking place. So we know that those people do exist. But in order to get to that point, to make that statement, obviously something has to be happening that doesn't sit well with them.
Well,
right?
And you have a direct quote here from a DHS analyst named Shayla Byers, who you say saw fit to remind those on the email thread that where First Amendment rights could be violated, and goes into some detail here. The government may never collect or disseminate information based solely on First Amendment protected activities or conduct investigations on that basis.
Right.
So this is pretty interesting. There's also a response from an individual and who you point out has the name, the designation Esquire, unredacted on the tail end of that person's name, who basically says, I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Right, right, yeah. So you can tell that there's, you know, the opinions are different. There's no one common thread in the sense of everyone felt a certain way. I mean, look, there, you know. The bottom line is this. We felt it was very important, by the way, as we were writing about this, to actually state what Department of Homeland Security does, what these fusion centers do. I mean, they're not supposed to be monitoring protest movements. You know, they're supposed to be, quote-unquote, protecting the homeland from threats. This is, you know, I'm sure some people out there obviously see this as a threat, but not the type of threat for which this massive bureaucracy was set up for. And that's one thing that really sticks out to me, at least, as I was reading, how huge the Department of Homeland Security is, how just the bureaucracy that's there, the fact that people work there, and some are unclear on what they are supposed to do. That there's one specific quote, you know, that I have in there in the article from an official who basically said that he was uncomfortable. He and someone else, you know, were uncomfortable by the intelligence product or memos that were being passed around because it did, in their opinion, you know, rise to the level of surveillance of protected First Amendment speech.
Here's one from October 31st. I fear that no matter how you parse a potential report, any product on Occupy Wall Street, which seeks to report on the movement in general or the potential for violence nationwide, would be largely reporting on First Amendment protected activity.
You think about that, and you know they needed to do something. And look, perhaps an argument can be made that that they needed to pay some sort of attention, you know, to Occupy Wall Street. However, you know, that has nobody stepped forward to make that argument. And if anything, what these documents show is that people really did. I mean, they really did want to, you know, monitor them, and they did. There's no question that they were monitored. But you know, it got to the point where you had reports that were issued that were not authorized, that were scrubbed, and you have to ask yourself, like, well, they you know, shouldn't they know what their job is prior to doing it? So it seems that, you know, this massive bureaucracy that gets $50 billion a year, if I'm not mistaken, that's what its budget is. You'd think that they put these folks through some more vigorous training on civil liberties, you know. So we actually don't see, you know, what's in these emails. I mean, the spokespeople, to me, that's actually very interesting as a journalist, where you have various media reaching out and asking, what is your role, Department of Homeland Security, with Occupy Wall Street? You know, the spokespeople will contact a higher up and say, how would you describe our activities? I mean, they don't even know, you know, what their activities are, what they're supposed to be doing, what they're allowed to do. I think there are some absolutely, you know, like I said, arguments that can and should be made for the fact that there were concerns, clear-cut concerns for civil liberties. It remains to be seen what the rest of these documents will show, however.
And Jason, one of the things that surfaced here on the West Coast was when Mayor Gene Kwan of Oakland, who is not the brightest bulb in the chandelier,
right,
and was on the defensive because she claims she didn't actually order the police to crack down on protesters, and she sent very mixed messages and pleased absolutely no one. But in a news conference where she was trying to defend her own actions, she mentioned that there had been a conference call with 18 different cities represented by mayors and police officials. And this is what sparked a lot of concerns, that there was a national coordinated force and that the DHS was taking on a KGB kind of role as a top-down way of getting things to occur by using or controlling or ordering local officials around.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, that's certainly troubling. And you know, this is a, we had this conversation previously where I pointed out, I think it was to one of your listeners, that is really important on the local level that people try and obtain, you know, documents, information, use their, you know, local, state, whatever it is, freedom of information laws to find out what's happening, you know, to find out what, you know, what the mayor is doing. It's amazing to me, Peter, that so many people are just simply unaware of what their, you know, what their rights are, what they are, and certainly on the law enforcement and government side, what they can and can't do. It's very disturbing, and the fact that, you know, what we see taking place on the federal level, security and the fear mongering, I believe, has trickled down to the local level. There's no question about that, or perhaps it trickled up, but where there's no doubt in my mind that it has informed the tactics that have taken place at the local level,
mm-hmm.
And not enough people are sort of outraged by it. There are many who are, clearly, but not enough.
Well, and here in San Francisco, there's a controversy, a modest one right now, over legislation put forward by Supervisor Jane Kim. And she wants transparency in any written agreements between the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force and the local police department.
Right.
And she's trying to set up a structure. I have to communicate with the police commission that regulates the activities of the police department in terms of the policies, practices, and specific investigations that might violate the constitutional rights of citizens of San Francisco.
Right.
And it's very interesting because I think this is great legislation. I think it's very important to push from the local level upward for clarity and controls on these kinds of relationships. But she's being ridiculed by even, you know, the allegedly liberal San Francisco Chronicle,
right,
which basically just takes the position that the federal government is all good and that there can be no reason that we need any kind of oversight of arrangements between the local police and the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
You know, I have to say, Peter, it's strange to me. I don't understand how that sort of attitude has where that came from. That rationale, that those assertions or even statements that we don't need any sort of oversight. The past 10 years, just the past decade since 9/11, has shown us, is proof that the oversight needs to be vigorous, and we need to be empower ourselves with, you know, and arm ourselves with information. The public needs to, you know, have this information. But the abuses, the widespread abuses that have taken place over the past 10 years, I don't understand how suddenly it's changed back to good. Where were these people, these journalists, these institutions, these publications, who all, you know, it's interesting to me, you said, you know, the fairly liberal San Francisco Chronicle. What were they saying during the Bush years? If that is their stance now, then why did they not have the same stance during George W. Bush's tenure? And I do believe that Barack Obama's presence in the White House, okay, plays a role in the way that certain reporters, publications cover activities such as this, and certainly the way that they cover civil liberties, terrorism, foreign policy. Because when you really stop and take the time to think about it, those particular policies are worse now than they were during, you know, when Bush was in office for 8 years. And I would be happy to have that debate and provide people with, you know, the documents, statements, links, and individuals to, you know, to show them that. So it doesn't make any sense to me where, you know, such journalists or such statements could be written. You know, I'm not saying that everyone needs to just completely distrust, you know, government. But look, you know, the abuses have been widespread and they're continuing.
Yeah, you got to be skeptical.
Yeah,
at minimum.
at minimum, exactly.
So, Jason, is there anything else of interest in the 400 pages released so far that you'd like to highlight?
Well, you know, there was a lot in there very early on about Anonymous, the you know, the hacktivist group,
mm-hmm.
That clearly they were concerned about, and the fact that, you know, Anonymous was involved or at least endorsing, you know, the Occupy movement, so there were some fears there. What's very interesting to me, there are several documents in this batch that are referred to as PRISM, PRISM, abstraction sort of reports from the Secret Service. And there are Secret Service monitoring Occupy Wall Street. On one particular day, November 3rd, the Secret Service put together, you know, a report. And it makes sense. You know, George W. Bush was visiting Goldman Sachs, and there was a protest taking place. So, you know, they put that together. But, you know, for the, you know, customer being the U.S. government. But there are also other Secret Service, you know, similar abstracts that don't show that the Secret Service agents were protecting anyone in you know, any former president or vice president They were simply just putting these reports out there as to why. I'm still trying to find out. And, you know, one thing I also want to highlight is that I thought, and I know many other people thought as well at their various protests, these vehicles, these Department of Homeland Security vehicles, and, you know, the mere presence of these vehicles suggested that, you know, to some people that there was, you know, look, they're monitoring, they're, you know, they're playing a hands-on role. Well, it's Federal Protective Service, which is, you know, part of DHS, and they were there, you know, in many places in which people saw these vehicles. It may have been because there was, you know, it was near federal property, federal park, but they were also there to monitor, which I noted in my story, and the agency that, you know, had arrested people in Portland because of a protest taking place mm-hmm. on federal property, at a federal park.
Now, Jason, you mentioned Anonymous back there a minute ago, and I'm just curious because obviously Anonymous is relatively anonymous. But last year I was interviewing Janet Reitman of Rolling Stone,
yeah.
who had written a book about Scientology. And I mentioned to her that starting in 2007, I received a series of emails that were from the email address Anonymous.
Right.
And they were critical comments or disclosures about David Miscavige, who is L. Ron Hubbard's successor, who uh-huh. runs Scientology with an iron fist. And so I asked Janet Reitman, I said, look, this may be, you know, seem really crazy. But I said that was sending me emails critical of Scientology. Does it have any connection to the group Anonymous that has been fighting back through hacking and denial of service tactics against, at that point, it was about Bradley Manning, WikiLeaks, and Julian Assange?
Right.
And she surprised me by saying, well, it's the same group. And I don't know what the evidence she has, because they are very murky, and after all, anybody can use the word anonymous, but do you have any indication of linkage between activists who were protesting the Church of Scientology and the current group that we know as Anonymous?
You know, I have to be honest with Peter. I do not know that at all, and I have not paid close attention to sort of the inner workings of Anonymous, so I'm not well educated
okay.
in that area.
Fine. The other thing I want to ask is, in your multiple FOIA requests, have you asked for any communications between DHS and their fusion centers and various FBI JTTFs, these Joint Terrorism Task Forces?
I have, indeed. In fact, that was yesterday, specifically with New York. But I have asked for it. There are some documents, emails here from fusion centers. I highlight that in my story, in which we talk about some of these spot reports that the fusion centers put out. Philadelphia Mega Center, Battle Creek, Michigan Mega Center, talking about you know, what's taking place. And you know, I will say also that you know, they describe the protest as a peaceful protest, but in some also they say we have redacted on the scene. You know, I have asked for them, and it does show that, again, in the documents that, you know, the fusion centers are the ones that, you know, wanted to know if headquarters, DHS headquarters, had any product, intelligence product, on Occupy. And there are some revelatory documents in there where, you know, again, DHS did, look, you know, no, this is a law enforcement matter. If there's anything, a local law enforcement matter, if there's anything that, you know, that is taking place, they'll deal with it. So, again, but that was just for certain requests. Los Angeles, that was actually, one of the requests from Los Angeles and the response that was given to, you know, the fusion center here.
Mm-hmm. And one last question, Jason, as you have delved into this, have you seen anything that defines the roles, responsibilities, and turf of DHS as compared to the FBI, which is the designated national law enforcement agency?
Right, yeah. You know, again, what the documents show is bureaucracy. A lot of what we really need to see are the documents from the local field offices that would really provide that kind of insight that, you know, you're talking about. And I think that from what I've understood or what I've gathered from, you know, some people who are knowledgeable about the way the field offices work is that they were working with, you know, with FBI, and they're very much a, you know, have that kind of that kind of power. You know, Department of Homeland Security, I mean, has quite a bit of power, and so do, you know, the agents assigned. That's why it's, you know, it's a massive bureaucracy. There is some documents in here showing how, you know, there are intelligence sharing database between FBI and DHS, and I think we've, you know, that's not a secret. We've known about that. But again, where this information was going back and forth. So to me, there's a lot of overlap, but it's still a bit unclear. I mean, it would make a great story to just flesh that out.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I'm curious. So put that on your list. Okay?
Yeah.
Well, Jason, good work, and keep us posted on further document dumps and other developments.
Thanks, Peter. Appreciate it.
Jason Leopold, he's deputy managing editor and a great investigative journalist at truthout.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again here at peterbcollins.com. And if you're a subscriber, you have my gratitude.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.